Okay, will Senate Education Committee come to order, please? This is Wednesday, March 12th, 2014. The time is 8 a.m. In attendance of myself, Stevens, Chair, Vice Chair Senator Dunleavy, Senator Gardner, and Senator Stebbins. We have a quorum. And today we're going to be considering two bills, Senate Bill 107, which is about K-3 student reading proficiency, and Senate Bill 139, the governor's education package. So I'd like to review the two committee substitutes for these bills and take public testimony. Not the intention to pass these bills out of committee today, but let's begin with Senate Bill 107. If we could have a motion, please.
I move we adopt SB 107, version U, as our working document, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I object for discussion purposes. And so the CS for Senate Bill 107 is before you. That's version U. And I call on Tim Lampkin, committee aide, to explain the changes that we find in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff of Senator Stevens. Good morning. Before us is Senate Bill 107, version U. I just want to report that we've been working on this bill. I thought I'd go through and point out some of the changes that we've made since the last hearing at the end of early February. If you note on page 2, line 5, we've changed reference to grade level expectations to grade level standards in reading. That was at the request of the department to reflect the new academic standards. Further down on that page, line section 3 there, first of all, we deleted a section that was referencing to accreditation because many elementary schools simply don't go through the process of accreditation. That's typically a secondary school level activity. So at the suggestion of the department, we also struck that reference to that requirement. Section 3 there, though, at the bottom of page 2 is new. It essentially applies this reading program or makes it applicable to charter schools as well, so they would be subject to also identifying students with reading deficiencies. Page 3, section 4, is consistent with that same requirement that charter schools would be required to participate. Section 5, page 5, line 18, there was previously a reference to periodically review, quote, diagnostic assessments, and that was viewed as being a little too inhibitive by the department, as there's a difference between screening assessments and diagnostics. So we removed reference to diagnostic and just had them review both their screening and diagnostics as they would determine through regulation. Further down on that page 5, where line 29 begins in section D, there was a section E there that also required the department to provide textbook and curriculum type of recommendations, and that was felt that that should remain a strictly a district level decision. So that reference of requiring certain textbook selections was deleted. Page 6, lines 3 and 4. There was reference there to including instructional materials in the same vein. Decided to strike that reference because, again, that should be more of a district-level decision to be made, not brought down by the department. We also changed coaching services and strategies to or strategies to give the district and the department the option of either or. Again, further down on page 6, line 26, including annual assessments. Again, we deleted the reference to diagnostic assessments for reasons already stated. And then further than on page 9, because of a new, my understanding is a new teacher evaluation rating system, we changed reference to teachers with having, quote, effective or, quote, highly effective.
What line is that, Tim?
Excuse me, line 25 on page 9.
Okay.
There was reference to teachers having a ranking of effective or highly effective, and that was to make it more in conformity with my understanding of a new teacher evaluation system to instead just call it high rating. That concludes the changes of the CS, Senator, Mr. Chairman. I, again, just want to report that some progress has been made on this bill. We've worked a fair amount with the department. To a lesser extent with the districts. We have heard a little bit from the districts, but my understanding through the chair that you'd like to hear more from the district level. You will probably hear that many districts are already doing a lot of this work, particularly through the RTI, Response to Instruction or Intervention. Some of those districts that are good models, my understanding, one of which is, for example, Kenai or Ketchikan, doing fairly good job with this sort of thing. But maybe other districts are not, and so this is an effort to maybe explore this issue a little bit further and find out how we can improve the program. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Any questions for Tim on the changes we have before us? Yes, Senator Gardner.
On the page 9, line 25, the teacher has a high rating. Is there any benefit in defining that rating, or I mean, what does a high rating mean? Adequacy, greater than adequate? I don't know.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that is part of the new evaluation system that they have, and I'm assuming that it is defined in regulation. I don't have it handy. I couldn't quote it to you, but I'm certain that the department is standing by to be able to answer more thoroughly for you.
Thank you.
We'll get that answer. Okay. Oh, thank you so much, Tim. And yes, please, department, come forward and see if we get an answer to that question. And for the record.
My name is Susan McCauley. I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning Support with the Department of Education and Early Development. The definitions would likely be provided for qualifying, so to speak, a teacher as, I forget the exact wording used in the bill, as having a quote-unquote high rating by virtue of our new teacher accountability regulations that require that an overall rating be given to every teacher now, one of four ratings. And so while this does not prescribe the exact words, it would likely be one of the two ratings that indicate that a teacher is proficient or higher in their practice as a teacher, as demonstrated through the evaluation system and the structure of an overall rating that is now required.
So you are comfortable with the wording as it is on the line 25?
Senator Stevens, my apologies. Could you tell me what page that is?
Sorry, page 9, line 25, and actually, line 25, it says high rating. Teacher has a high rating.
Yes, Senator Stevens, we are comfortable with that.
Thank you. Further question, Senator?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do with this section is to ensure that a student who is not performing at a grade level gets a highly effective teacher, basically, somebody who's an expert in reading and has demonstrated effectiveness. Can we be confident that, say, in a very tiny school, that such a person is available, and what would be the consequences if not?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I think that the words whenever practicable are relevant and recognize exactly the situation potentially that you describe. The idea here is, it's my understanding in conversation with the sponsor, is that it is to do exactly what you described, and that is, when possible, want to ensure that, let me just read this one more time, sorry.
Sure.
That students are receiving reading instruction, when possible, from teachers who have high ratings on their most recent performance evaluations and who possess expertise in reading instruction. I mean, we're talking about early literacy, and we're talking about those early years of learning to read. Arguably, there is a science to this. And the intent, it is my understanding, would be to ensure that folks, whenever possible, who are teaching reading to young children have expertise in doing so. And the science, as well as the art, of course, about how to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we'd hope that every child has the access to that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. McCauley. I appreciate your comments early on that for many districts, this would not be a high lift, a hard, I don't remember the term used, but anyway, that would many districts are already doing this, but this would bring all districts into some kind of compliance on reading. You have any other comments from the department or the department? Okay, anything further?
We've continued, Senator Stevens, to have conversation, most specifically since this is the area that has most relevance to our impact on the department. Page 6, lines 3, 4, and 5, just wanting to be really sure that we understand what is envisioned there regarding our providing technical assistance and coaching services or strategies to school districts. So when we're talking about this and thinking about this from the perspective of the department's responsibility to do these things, that's where the majority of our focus has been. And so the latter half of the bill really does have more impact for districts regarding district reading plans and student reading plans. And so I think it is important to hear from them regarding their perception of impact for them. We've really focused most closely here, and as was said, the recent change saying that we would provide coaching services or strategies is what we've worked on most recently to ensure that we have capacity to do one or the other of those.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your comments, Dr. McCauley. We do hope to hear from more superintendents and districts on their reaction to this. We've heard some, but not very much. And now we'll go on to public testimony. Tim, do we have some folks to testify? And if there are any superintendents or districts here, we'd be glad to hear from them at this point. If not, we'll move on to folks that want to testify. And my plan is to wrap this up by 8:30 so we can get on to the governor's bill. Valerie Brooks, Ms. Brooks from Ketchikan, thank you for being here. Good to see you.
Good morning. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I ask kind of a question on the record, sure. And if there are school district representatives listening, and if they could answer it for their districts, I'd appreciate that.
Yes, I don't think we have any district superintendents online. We don't have none signed up at this point, but encourage them to let us know.
At some point, but I just kind of like to know if people have information about this particular question. And
about which particular question?
Okay, a question I'd like to ask.
Okay.
On page 9, item 4, line 27, it says, when necessary and with the approval of a student's parent, the student receives mental health support from a school psychologist, school social worker, or school counselor. And I believe that with recent cuts, it's possible there are some schools that don't have any of those personnel in the building or access to them. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'd just like to know if people can meet that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it's a very good question. Mr. Johnson, would you mind if I call on you to respond, representing...
Thank you.
And maybe we can at least get some response, and then we'll get right back to you, Valerie.
That's fine. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, the Executive Director for the Alaska Council of School Administrators that represents principals, superintendents, and business officials. And if I could have the question repeated...
One of the requirements, proposed requirements in the statute would be page 9, line 27, it says, when necessary, this is talking about children who are not making expected progress, when necessary and with the approval of the student's parent, the student receives mental health support from the school psychologist, school social worker, or school counselor. So my question is, do all children enrolled in a public school have access to those services in their building?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner.
on the hook here, but I appreciate your response.
It's all kids have access. It may not be immediate access in terms of those types of services. They're delivered by itinerants. In some cases, there are local mental health officials, nurses, things of that nature in villages, and so they do have that level of access, but certainly it's not guaranteed and often is not in a particularly timely manner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate that. Appreciate you coming forward. Thank you. Valerie, if we'd ask you to come back again, please.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Senator Dunleavy.
Quick question.
Was it the intent on number four on page 9, line 27, seems to be compelling language. It's not contingent upon a school having a counselor or a psychologist. It's when the child needs that service. So if you're in a village school 200 miles from any of those services, that would lead me to believe that the district will then be compelled to provide those services. Is that correct?
And I guess I'd ask if this is a change to what is now being done, and maybe we should have the department come forward and also respond to that if they would. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce.
For the record, Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support. Again, I just would like to reread this briefly.
Sure. We're on line 27.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the words "when necessary," my read of them do imply that's not correct. My read of them would probably concur with yours, and that is that when it is perceived by someone, perhaps though that could be as well the student's parents, as necessary for a student to receive mental health support from the school psychologist, school social worker, or school counselor, a district would need to ensure that that happen. And as was stated, there is not necessarily immediate access in all areas of Alaska to those services. There would be on an itinerant basis, but those folks could be a plane ride or two away, honestly, and at the district office location. So perhaps consideration of the words "when necessary" might be a good thing.
Thank you. We'll certainly work on that. Senator, go ahead.
Through the chair, Dr. McCauley, but that's what does say is "when necessary." Are you saying, I'm not sure what you're saying. You ended your testimony by saying something along the lines of "when necessary."
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, if I compare and contrast number 4, line 27, with number 3 on line 24 above, mm-hmm. the words "whenever practicable" might be worth consideration with regard to number 4, line 27 as well, in order to not necessarily require under difficult circumstances that those services be provided.
Yeah, and just through the chair, whenever necessary from a superintendent standpoint is going to be compelling language on the part of the school. If they don't have the resources, they're going to have to fit the bill. If so, you may want to jack up your fiscal note by a considerable amount of money to deal with this. Because if you have when necessary in there and you did not provide services, especially if there's an incident or a court says you should have because of the law, then the school district's going to be looking at a potential suit as well. So you either have to put a lot of money into your fiscal note to get counselors in all the villages or take a second look at your language.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy, and that's a very good point. Not the intention of this bill to dramatically increase psychologists, social workers, or school counselors. It's a reading bill, and so we take that to heart, and we'll try to work on that that paragraph. Thank you, Dr. McCauley. Ms. Brooks, thank you for your patience.
Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. For the record, my name is Valerie Brooks. I'm a reading and instructional specialist at a school-wide Title I school in Ketchikan. My comments this morning are my own. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 107, specifically the components of the bill relating to reading and to early literacy instruction. In Ketchikan, we are in the sixth year of our implementation of response to instructional intervention model. Of assessment and instruction known as RTI, sometimes RTI squared, a response to instruction and to intervention. SB 107 delineates an RTI approach to student assessment and instruction, emphasizing the use of research-based programs to address students' below proficient skills, professional development opportunities for staff charged with implementing these programs and utilizing them for student instruction, and frequent progress monitoring to assess student performance, to determine acceptable progress, and to diagnose continued or altered instructional interventions. Research, my own included, indicates that this approach to specific skills, instruction, and assessment can result in fairly rapid and significant increases in student academic skills across the curriculum and can aid in the determination of special needs status for students requiring this additional level of instruction and accommodations. My concern is that the additional reporting responsibility for districts and the mandated coaching services noted in the bill as department responsibilities will not be funded adequately and thus become a burden on districts rather than the support intended for increased instructional opportunities. I hope the committee and the department might solicit input from stakeholders responsible for implementing this RTI model of assessment and instruction, and I applaud this focus on early literacy and reading instruction, and urge the committee to ensure that support for districts and the department is evident in materials and training and funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brooks. I appreciate your comments. Any questions or thoughts?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Todd Hindeman from Nome, is he online with us? Or here? Yes. Okay. Thanks so much. Thank you, Todd. All right. We're waiting for some response from some districts. We need to hear from them and find out what it really is going to require of them if this is implemented. Send down a bit.
Through the chair, I'd be curious if the School Boards Association or the school counselors, or administrators association has taken a stand on the bill. Do they have any thoughts, or do any of your members have any of your members? Where are your members?
Good morning again. For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, the executive director for the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and our superintendents were just in town for a fly-in. We discussed Senate Bill 107. We discussed it in relationship to regulations that have recently come from the Department of Education that direct low-performing schools with designations 1 through 3. I think much of what is included in this bill is captured in those regulations. Obviously, regulations don't have the weight of statute, so we appreciate that. I think from a superintendent perspective, they would prefer that we meld those two in some way so that we have a system that works well without confusion, that's clearly supported by the department, and that technical assistance that might be necessary, particularly in our low-performing schools, would be required. I think much of what's in here is done through the RTI model, and as Chair Stevens suggested, not every district may have a robust RTI model, response to intervention, but we're working hard on this. There were 1,100 individuals attending the most recent RTI conference in, and that was the third conference held annually in late January in Anchorage. So people are taking this very seriously. We clearly understand the importance of reading going forward for every single child, and a lot is being done in this area. So we remain willing to work with the sponsor as well as the department to assure that what comes out makes good sense, and that we have good alignment between current regulations, even if they need to be realigned as a result of something that may be left out at this point in time. But there's no pushback from superintendents on the importance of this issue. The pushback is, do we need more paperwork and those sorts of things? We want to avoid that, obviously, and I'm sure you do as well, as the sponsor and has indicated. So we're willing to do what we can to advance this in a way that makes good sense for all of Alaska. I might add the one last piece here is I do think that our priority are those low-performing schools and school districts, and that's where the real emphasis should be, and not add a burden to districts that may not need this guidance at all. I think that's been a topic and before this committee in the past. If students are proficient, let's get out of their way and let them kind of move forward with the supports that are working nicely for them from home and school. So That's where the superintendents are at this juncture. And the principals will be in town here in the next week or so, so they'll be able to address this head-on if it's up before the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. I think it's exactly where we've come to, is that we don't want it to be a burden on those districts that are already doing a great job. We want to make sure that that we're not adding extra workload for them, and really identify work on the schools that are having more difficulties. Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and I'll agree with your comments, Mr. Chair, but I want to add that isn't it also true that even a high-performing district and an excellent school might have a few kids who are struggling and need this kind of service?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, you're absolutely right, and most of those districts are doing that, and largely through response to intervention. So they are creating those individual plans for young people that are struggling. They're involving the parents, those sorts of things. So that's part of that model that most of Alaska has adopted, the response to intervention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Senator Levitt.
Through the chair, Mr. Johnson, what do you see from your perspective and your members' perspective, what do you see this bill doing that they're not doing? Or in other words, what would this bill help them do that they are not doing?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think it's district dependent in terms of how closely they've aligned themselves with the regulations. It's a little early to see how that is all going to unfold and where there may be some gaps. I think more than anything, this keeps our eye on a real important issue, and that is getting all kids reading at the earliest level possible. Again, no pushback there from our superintendents. They value this as much as you all value it. And how we get there with the least amount of paperwork and district flexibility for those that have things in place. Let's not add additional burdens there.
Thank you. Well, I'll remove my objection to the motion, and if there are any other objections to adopting it, see us for Senate Bill 107 version U as our working document. I appreciate knowing that. Any objection to this being our working document? We know we have a long ways to go on this bill. The main expectation I have at this point is that we will receive a fiscal note for version U, and at this time, then we'll set Senate Bill 107 aside for further review. So next up is Senate Bill 139.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move we adopt SB 139 version U as our working document.
Thank you. Again, I'll object for discussion purposes. We have the CS before us. Tim Lemkin, if you'd explain the changes that we have in front of us in this bill. And they are considerable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff, Senator Stevens. Before you is Senate Bill 139, version U. I thought I would first go through the sections of the bill individually and explain the changes or lack of changes from the original bill. Starting with Section 1 on page 2, it is unchanged from the original version. That is the section regarding when students choose or wish to challenge a course that they feel that they have already mastered without taking it and receive course credit. Section 2 is also the same as the original bill. It essentially is regarding the repeal of the exit exam. It surgically removes it and its reporting requirements. Likewise, with regard to Section 3 on page 3, also has to do with the exit exam. It remains unchanged from the original bill. Section 4 also has to do with in the accountability system, repealing the exit exam requirements. At the bottom of page 4, you may note that there's a section missing. What we did take out of the governor's bill currently is any reference to requiring an assessment in order to graduate. That is to say that the student would not have to take the ACT, the SCT, or work keys in order to graduate. The thinking there that they are currently already doing that at the regulatory level, requiring students in the 11th grade to take work keys. It is, my understanding is it's paid for by the department, They could continue to provide the option for students to take an assessment that could be paid for by the department as a one-time deal. But thinking so far is that it just not necessarily be a requirement to take an exam in order to get a diploma. And I'd be happy to explain that further if you wish. Otherwise, I'd go on.
Maybe just help us understand the diploma will still have work keys on it, right, or not? Still will have it on the diploma.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
How the student does.
That's my understanding, though, that some I believe that that's a district-level decision, whether they put that score on their diplomas, and that would remain a district-level decision. I could be wrong. The department would correct me on that, but that's my understanding.
Okay. Let's go ahead.
Section 5 on page 5, with regard to the application of a charter school. Here the policy change is that rather than the commission, if a local school district denies a charter school application, rather than the commissioner having the final say up or down, the commissioner would instead review the application and forward his or her recommendations to the state board, who then would give the final yay or nay on that application. So the commissioner would still be involved, but that he would only give recommendations to the state board, who would have that ultimate decision to make.
Thank you. And we'll get to that if the commissioner has comments on it later. Please continue.
Section 7 is this on page 6 is the same as the original bill. It regards charter schools reporting about the exit exam. It repeals that requirement. Section 8, bottom of page 6, is the same, except there was a deletion of the reference to pupil transportation from that section. That is where the local school board, it would require that local school boards provide for pupil transportation. However, later in the bill, I'll come to it, that there is a section that provides for the option for them to work out an agreement. I'll come back to that in a later section. The Section 8 simply deletes the requirement that there be public transportation provided. Page 7, Section 9 is the same. However, note that there was a section removed that had to do with the duties of the board establishing regulations for an assessment for the ACT-SAT work key. Since we're deleting that, then that section was removed. Section 10 is the same as the original bill. Section 11, on the bottom of page 7 and top half of page 8, is the section I referred to a moment ago, whereas a school district would have the opportunity to negotiate with the charter school to provide pupil transportation services. It wouldn't be necessarily a requirement, but that this is an attempt to adapt a policy that would allow for some means of pupil transportation issue to be addressed. This is also consistent with an amendment that was adopted in the other body. Section 12 on page 8 is the same that regards applications for residential boarding schools. Likewise, on Section 13, page 8 and 9, regarding the boarding school stipends, that those figures are the same as the original bill. My understanding through the chair is that we would allow the Finance Committee to determine those funding levels.
I like that. Allow the Finance Committee. they will do what they want, but I think it's important that we give them the options that they may need. Thank you. Go ahead.
Page 9, Section 14 is a new section. It also addresses charter school funding in the context of equitable funding. This is a policy area that has been explored a number of times over the years. As regards a charter school being considered a separate school for funding purposes within a district, rather than currently their ADM has to be 150 or more to be considered a separate school, this would lower it to 75 students per charter school, which significantly increase the number of charter schools eligible for separate school funding. The department would, I think, be available to go into much greater detail on the financing of that policy. Section 15, 16, and 17 have to do with the BSA. Again, as announced by the chair, is electing at this time not to address changes in the BSA funding. Again, that would be determined by the Finance Committee. So those figures are currently the same as was proposed in the original bill. Page 10, Section 18 and 19 have to do with the TVET funding, the Technical Vocational Educational Programs. The original bill would sunset this funding at 2014. That is a 10-year extension. Historically, this has been up to a 5-year extension. This CS would propose it be a 4-year extension to sunset it in 2018. It also slightly changes the allocation structure of those technical regional training centers. First and foremost, I think a number of these, four of the current technical training centers have since changed their name since this statute was adopted years ago. So when you see the changes of these names, that's the current name of those entities. So it's kind of a housekeeping change there. It merges UAS with the University of Alaska, since it's been stated on the record that it flows through the university statewide anyway, and it allows for improved southeast representation of technical regional training centers. Section 19 follows up with the TVET funding to allow number 8 there on page 11, line 16, 17, to an effort to give the Department of Labor a little bit more teeth in requiring financial information from these entities. It's also the intent here, as we move forward with this bill, to also set up some more performance measures and perhaps even an audit of these institutions before the next sunset. Page 11, sections 20 and 21 regarding articulation agreements and dual credits for these regional training centers. That's the same as the original bill. Page 12, sections 22 through the remainder of the bill, sections 22 through 33 have to do with tax credits. And the change there is at the request of the Association of Village Council Presidents, we added some language there in line 6 of page 12 and operations to accommodate some more nonprofit tribal organizations' involvement in these types of activities. That's also, you'll see on page 12, line 13, 14, to allow if they run a vocational education center, monies received by a corporate entity would also apply toward a tax credit. I believe they are online, or you should have in front of you a letter that was very recently received this morning. Looks like this, that speaks to those amendments. It's this one here.
Thank you.
Also then on page, as regards to tax credits, and this same language is identical through the rest of the bill in the tax credit sections. On the bottom of page 12, top of 13, there's reference to if a corporate entity provides monies for early childhood programs, early learning, pre-K, that sort of thing, that would also be applied as a tax credit. This is also consistent with amendments that were at least proposed, if not adopted, it was late last evening in the other body. I was unable to determine if indeed those were adopted. I'll skip through the tax credit sections are all identical with what I just described. If we move then to page 20, line 20, those are the statutes specifically on establishing regulations for the exit exam. So since we're repealing exit exam, those regs requirements are repealed. So it's the same as the original bill. The section 35 there was originally transition language to allow for phasing out of the exit exam, but since we would make it an immediate effective date that there no longer be an exam, and we I'm coming up to the next issue here, instead of having a transition phasing out the exam, we retroactively go back and give diplomas to students that passed all of their local requirements at the district level, got all their math and writing and English credits and so forth, but yet for whatever reason failed the actual exit exam itself and got a certificate of attendance. So at the request of the student, it would be on their burden would be to the effort of the department would be to advertise that we're doing this. The students out there would then be responsible to contact the district in order to get their diploma.
Question. Yes, Senator Donovan.
Thank you, through the chair. So This is retroactive to any and all students that have ever taken the exam?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it would be retroactive to those that have taken and failed the exam and otherwise passed all their courses and would have gotten a diploma or passing acceptable grades, but for whatever reason failed the exam.
But going back many years possibly as well?
It would be to 2004 is when we started taking the exam. And if the data is in your packet that show there's, I can only ballpark it, but the students that failed it after three attempts, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, that number got smaller and smaller and smaller. So I'm guessing maybe 1,000
no,
ballpark.
No. I'm just wondering if it's going back to the inception of the concept of the high school qualifying exam. If a student failed a high school qualifying exam back years and years ago, they can come forward to the department and get a retroactive diploma. I just want to make sure I'm reading this correctly.
If they fail the exam and passed all their courses.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Everyone really struggled with this one, Senator Dunleavy, because if we say that the exit exam is no longer necessary, we don't find it important, and we're doing away with it, yet we're forcing students to keep taking it, even though it's decided it's not important. It's sort of a strange situation. So we've got to find the right way to do it retroactive, and maybe that needs some massaging here on how far we want to go back. Tim.
Continuing then with Section 36, that language is the same. It regards the transition for charter school applications and appeal process. 37 is also the same as the original bill. Section 38 is the effective date for the TVEP funding. It is the same as original bill. Section 39 is regards the BSA increase, number one, effective date. Section 40 is the effective dates for the course challenging, the BSA number two, and the TVEP reporting. And on that note, I would recommend that on Section 40, Sections 19 and 21 effective dates should that's regards the TVEP reporting. That may be advisable to make an immediate effective date or July 1st of 2014. Again, because of the performance measures that we're trying to put in place so that they begin reporting on that information sooner than later. Section 41 is effective date for the BSA number three. That's the same as the original bill. Section 42 are the effective dates for the tax credits, which note that is the same for the bill effective 2021. And then the final section is the bill itself effective date. That concludes the changes of the CS, Mr. Chairman. I believe we have the department and probably quite a few people online ready to testify.
Thank you very much, Tim. Very comprehensive bill, covers a lot of material. I know we need to discuss it pretty extensively. Any thoughts at this point? Any questions for Tim? Yes.
Thank you, and thanks very much for your presentation, Tim. I think I think more slowly than you speak, so I might have misunderstood or missed a couple of things. Did I understand that we are removing in this proposal the requirement for ACT, SAT, or work keys exam?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's correct. There would longer be a required assessment in order to get a diploma.
Thank you. I agree with that. On the excuse me, I'm looking for my notes here. We had some letters from a proposed TVEP site in Southeast asking for 5% to come out of UAS's. And because there's some name changes here, and I don't remember the exact name, but it was the Southeast something or other, is that included, that specific facility included in the Section 18 on page 10?
Page 10, right.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
The list of facilities that are participating, I know the names changed. Did we add anybody else here?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, we're adding Southern Southeast Tech Center.
Okay, and do you know if that's the group that has been emailing us about wanting to be a part of it?
Through Chair Senator Gardner, I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
And they are online, Senator, to testify here.
Okay, I don't have a problem with it. I just wanted to understand. Section 22 on page 12 and in other places too, regarding funding a scholarship by nonprofit organization to a dual credit student for tuition registration. Do we know if there are any such scholarships in place right now, or are we just anticipating and hoping somebody will do that? And then related to that, are they open to all students, or if they come from a tribal organization, are they open only to members of that tribe?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I certainly couldn't speak to the tribal question. I suspect that there are such scholarships out there, but this would certainly add an incentive for there to be more.
Thank you. Well, I guess my concern about that is I just want to make sure if we're providing a state tax benefit for such scholarships, I'd like to make sure that everybody who is in that region can potentially qualify. Thank you.
And we'll ask the department about that specific question, too. Further comments?
I think I had another question. Excuse me just a minute, Mr.
Sure.
Chair. I guess that's it for right now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Gardner.
That's for you.
Tim, I think that does that, and we'll ask the department to come forward and respond. Commissioner and Dr. McCauley, thank you for being here. This is a very big bill.
And a very important one. Thank you, Chair Stevens. For the record, my name is Mike Hannum, the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development. Are you looking for some overall thoughts?
Yes, yes. And maybe some answers to the specific things
sure.
that came through, too.
Okay. I'd like to begin with the removal of the requirement for the SAT-ACT. Currently, the requirement for work keys in the 11th grade is in regulation and will still be required. What this bill simply did was when all 11th graders were required to take the work keys, that this added a choice. So if students felt like, look, I'm heading to a college, I know what I want to do, an ACT or SAT score is more important to me than a work key score, it just simply gave them that choice. So the removal of that language from this bill removes the the requirement for the SAT or ACT. The work keys remains. So
if I can understand that, Tricia, the diploma that students receive throughout the state would all, if I guess they're required by the district, would all have an indication of how kids do on work keys? Will we be able to compare that from district to district, or will that will remain on the diploma, is that right?
Chair Stevens, there's a difference between a diploma and a transcript, I think. So,
okay.
Yes, work keys would be a part of a transcript, but
right.
not necessarily
okay.
attached directly to a diploma. But currently there is a requirement to take the work keys in 11th grade.
Right.
And other opportunities afterwards in 12th grade. So that I understand the removal of that component, but it's in my mind, and when we put this together, that simply removes the choice. Now students simply are back to only have a requirement just to take the work keys as opposed to having the choice of taking the tool, using the tool that they feel best fits them. The other reason for adding those two is those three assessments, ACT, SAT, and the work keys, are three qualification tools for the performance scholarship. And the work keys will allow you to move towards a career track. The other two move you towards a college track. And we felt it was important to, if that's a requirement, then we should remove that barrier of cost for students to qualify.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
So under the current status where students are required to take it, if they don't take the work keys, does that mean they don't graduate?
I'd have to look at language, specifically on how it's written there. If the language that was written in here said that it was required, and if you didn't take one of these, you'd receive a certificate of achievement instead of a diploma, I would have to look at the regulatory language and see if that's how it's written.
Okay. Well, I can't speak for the rest of the committee members or for the chair, but for myself, that requirement in order to get a diploma didn't sit right with me.
Right. And I would have to look at regulations. I don't recall if it's a requirement that it be given or it's a requirement to take it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
There might be some clarification needed on my part, and on a couple of one component was the application of the charter school, and the language of the previous bill.
And the page.
I'm looking at page 5 and
section 5 and 6. Right.
And not referring to specific line just yet. Excuse me. The appeal would go to the commissioner. The commissioner had three choices, and actually that part is on the top of page 6, lines 2, 3, and 4. The commissioner had three choices: to remand it back to the local board for further review, to approve the charter school application, in which case it would go to the state board with a recommendation for approval from the commissioner and a denial from the local board, and ultimately the state board makes that final decision now, and it would make the final decision here. Or I could, or the commissioner could deny that, basically confirm a denial. At that point, you have two denials. Those still go to the state board, but it's more informational at that point. The board doesn't relook at those and have sole power to override the two denials. So ultimately, the state board is the final decision maker. I see that the language is still here that puts those three choices in place at the appeal level. So I'm not, I'm just not clear as to the explanation of how that changed it with the explanation that was given. So I don't know if you want to deal with that now or later.
Well, if we can, Tim, would you just make room for Tim there, and we'll see if we can. We'll just pull a chair up. That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you. And if you could remind us how we got to this point, Tim.
For the record, Sam Lampkin, staff, Senator Stevens. So the intent of this section of the bill is to allow the state board to have the final say. The interpretation of the original bill was that the commissioner would have the final say on a denial. If that makes sense. So the purpose or the intent of this section is to allow, if a local school board denies an application for charter school, that appeal is made to the commissioner. The commissioner would then come up with his or her recommendations to the state board, and the state board would then say yes or no, as opposed to the original bill where the commissioner would have the option of saying no, and that's it, period.
Well, you're the one that's going to have to do this. What do you think?
Chair Stevens, I think we're very close in language and intent. And comments I have made in the past were, in effect, if the commissioner denies an appeal, that stops the process. Because of current statutory language, it still goes to the state board, but not for their own opportunity to approve. So maybe the intent of this was still that the board would review it independently, even if there were two denials, that they would still review it independently. That could be clarified, and maybe it is here, and I just hadn't had a chance to review all the language. But ultimately, all denials, all approvals go to the state board. Approvals get potential final approval from the state board. Denials are there for information's sake more than overturning.
Thank you. I think we're close, and I think we can work out this if we can just get together.
We'd be glad to work with the sponsor and make sure that we have the language, because I do believe we're looking at the same intent.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other particular...
Well, let's see. I'm trying to go through my notes here to see what else we had talked about that we might department on. The issue of on page 9 of charter schools changing the student count to at least 75 instead of 150. What your response to that? What difficulties that we face in making such a change, and just good to hear what you have to say about that, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Stevens. I believe that this is a change that simply removes a barrier for some charter schools. When we have a size restriction of 150 in there, it does a couple things. One is it requires that schools need to hit that mark right off the bat. And it also, I was in Ketchikan yesterday looking at charter schools and some other things, and they have a couple of charter schools, and one is a K-6 program, and they're struggling to hit that 150 mark. The other one decided that they had to go to K-8 so that they could hit that 150 mark. And so we're finding that the 150 mark is this barrier that's starting to drive program so that they can get to that mark. So basically what this does is it lowers it to 75. The previous language, when a school a charter school dropped below 150, we said held harmless, but they received 95% of the funding. So we kept that at full funding at the 150 level, but now schools can be down to a 75, and we think that just provides additional flexibility for smaller schools that might want to just be a K-3 or a K-6 and have a hard time hitting that full 150, especially right off the bat. So it's just when we look at, if we were to put that into place today, it would impact two charter schools right now in the state. Total amount would be around $200,000 that would provide additional funding for those schools. But it also takes out that barrier to where now schools can say, let's get back to our mission. We don't need these to add more students that we felt like we had to for funding. Let's get back to our core mission, and I think it just provides that flexibility.
Right. Good point. Thanks very much.
Yes,
please go ahead.
I would be glad to speak to the HSGQE with your permission.
Yes,
let me look back at the language there. We are on section 2, I believe. No.
Page 2.
So page 20, line 23. I think we've all agreed that at this point in time, with an educational system that has developed higher standards and new expectations, that our educational system has evolved around a static HSGQE, and it no longer has a particular value. So I understand the retroactive part, but you know, in my mind, when I look at a policy decision, it seems to state that in 2004, when the HSGQE was put in place, it had no purpose. And I believe it did. I believe it did meet an important requirement for us to be able to measure and at least set a standard for us to measure our kids with. And I understand the idea about, you know, fiscal efficiency at this point and just stopping it and going back, but it does seem to negate the purpose that it once had, that it no longer has as the rest of our educational system has moved forward. So I would just share that, and obviously the committee can continue to deliberate on that. I would also consider, there was some powerful testimony earlier to a Senate committee. I don't remember which Senate committee. There was a gentleman who spoke about his son who had to come back and delayed his college and come back, and that's one of the reasons we're looking at removing it. I don't know what a reaction to someone who worked hard and took it 5 times in high school, came back and worked hard to get it, and only to find that all of his peers now never had to go through that. So for those students who have retaken it and have come back, said, I want my diploma, and their peers who said, I don't want to bother with it, now get the same diploma, I don't see a legal challenge in there. I just see some disappointment on people's faces who buckled down, did the test, raised the bar for themselves, and got what was in front of them. And then had somebody else just handed it to them. That is just simply a personal thought that I have. I think ultimately we're looking at removing the HSGQE. How we get there is now what we discuss. But
Well, thank you, Rashi. That's a very good point. There was a value to it. Everyone agreed nationwide. People were doing exit, states were doing exit exams. Certainly, you know, we were not alone in that. I guess I'm still concerned about what do we do now? I mean, do we not do retroactivity? Do we say you still have to take the test even though we've abandoned it? I don't know the answer to that.
Chair Stevens, I would only offer those options of minimizing the transition language or minimizing the retroactive part. Does it go back 10 years? Does it go back 5 years? Maybe the argument about retroactive stays the same, whether it's 10 or 5, it's the same. I don't know, but those are the things we all wrestle with. And I know the governor had a vision for removing it, and I know the other bills that have passed have had a vision for removing it. That's what we want to get to. I thought just at this committee, I would share those thoughts.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
I think what you're saying is true. There's no way to be completely fair. Somebody last year had to take it. Somebody next year doesn't, no matter where you draw the line. And there are a lot of such examples. And I just think my dad used to say, well, life's not fair when I complained. It's not. You can't make it fair for everybody all the time. So the question is then, what is the most right or the best outcome for the most people?
Yeah. Agreed.
Well, thank you. Work with us on that one. Go ahead.
Chair Stevens, when I look at, and I don't know that you need to reference a page, when I first heard that the pupil trans was removed, I considered the conversations that I've had with the governor that we're looking for equity here with our charter schools. I do believe that the language that was added later, that that the pupil trans, and this is on page, the top of page 8, a school district that provides transportation services under this section shall provide transportation services to students attending a charter school operated by the district under a policy adopted by the district. The idea is equity, and I believe that this language changes what was in the original bill, but I still think meets the intent.
Thank you, Senator Gardner.
Mr. Chair, you know, if we're going to talk about equity or fairness, I'm still troubled by the fact that we're going to provide pupil transportation for kids in neighborhood schools. We anticipate a path for pupil transportation for charter schools, but do nothing for the non-charter alternative schools. So, there, you know, we're not providing any more equity, and in terms of alternative schools, we're favoring the charter schools over the non-charter alternative schools.
Chair Stevens, I think when that were the, in places where that takes place, I think you're correct. And I think the question in my mind would be, if I was a student and a parent with a student at an alternative school that received no transportation, and there's language in there that says the funds generated by students, you know, that why should the neighborhood kids get transportation and I'm not, I think that's a strong local conversation. And I guess it's a question if the state needs to step into that. Charters are addressed here because they have a different structure than alternative schools. But I would agree if there's disparity there, I think that there is definitely room for conversations. It's just whether it takes place at the state level or with those parents addressing it at the school board level, mm-hmm. The local school board level.
Thank you.
With my first view, but I was listening carefully to the presentation that Tim gave. I believe that the other changes here fit the intent of the original bill.
TVAP, have we discussed that at all?
We didn't discuss TVAP. And
page 10.
The original bill did not address the recipients of TVAP funds, and we really and we haven't weighed in, and that largely falls into the Department of Labor.
Sure.
And I think it's really the prerogative of how this money gets divvied up. The one component that adds to on page 11, line 16, that was added that fits in with kind of some language that we originally put in. line 8 and line 12 offer descriptions of simply recognizing that dual credit should be offered and there should be an articulation agreement with a high school. It adds some requirements for those entities that are receiving TVET funds. That's what we put in. That the additional one there, number 8 on line 16, that other performance and financial information is determined by the department to verify the performance of the program. In this case, I believe the department would be the Department of Labor. I understand it's just simply an accountability measure that they have the tools to go in, and I think it was spoke to well previously. So the Department of Education doesn't have any issues with that. And I don't want to speak for the Department of Labor. It seems to be pretty straightforward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any comments on the tax credit portion?
The tax credit offering and looking at the top bottom of page 12 and the top of page 13, the last line on page 12, it's the Childhood Early Learning and Development Program. I surely think that it's an appropriate use of tax credits. I don't have any problem with that being added to the bill. I think it would be up to the Department of Revenue, as long as it's got enough clarity for them to understand when a tax credit is given. And I looked at the language and it said, just reading it, childhood early learning and development programs and educational support to childhood early learning and development programs provided by a nonprofit. So educational support to childhood, it really becomes a corporation saying, you know, applying for a tax credit because they've provided that service and the Department of Revenue understanding, yes, it did fit the meaning of this. So I couldn't speak to how that they would interpret that. It seems broad. It seems appropriate. My understanding is that it would allow not only your nonprofit preschools but also educational support programs, potentially like Best Beginnings, Parents as Teachers, and those organizations.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Questions?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Commissioner, do you know if there are any existing scholarship programs for students going to residential schools for tuition, textbooks, that kind of thing in place already?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of any. Not any specifically. I am aware of several Native corporations that offer scholarships to, not necessarily dual credit, but offer some types of scholarships and support for students who are pursuing further education. And I've heard that when we talked about the performance scholarship, and I've been to different districts, students are sharing with me other places they're receiving funds. I couldn't speak specifically to those or in regards to a tax credit, though.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I think unless there's something else to do, we'll move on to some public testimony, and I appreciate your thoughts. Yes. So we have, and I do hope I did object for discussion, which I'm sure I did. And now we're going to, before we move on to public testimony, I want to remove my objection to the motion. Is there any other objection to the motion before us, which is to adopt the U-version as our working document? No objection to that, then. That will be our working document, and we'll look forward to getting an updated fiscal note on this as soon as possible. My goal here is to try to move this out by Friday or Monday if we can. I know it's a very complex bill, but I think we need to get it back in the process and moving along the way it should. So let's move on to public testimony on this bill, and we'll begin with Charlene Arneson, the president of the Chugach District. Charlene, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
If you get a little closer to the mic, please, Charlene.
Yes, this is Charlene Arneson, for the record. And I'm with the Chugach School District, and I want to be sure that I'm testifying on the right bill.
Yeah, this is Senate Bill 139. We sort of call it the governor's omnibus bill, and deals with all of the issues we've been talking about. Charlene?
Yes, thank you so much. The success of schools and students help the economy and strengthens communities. Schools are not flush with money. Without FC 139 hundreds of personnel across the state will be laid off. Even with SB 139 funding, there will be budget cuts and jobs lost to pay for rising transportation, energy, insurance, and personnel costs. Basic student allocation remained unchanged for, if it remains unchanged for another year. Local school boards have invested in success to improve the statewide graduation rate. Alaska's dropout rate has steadily decreased over the same time. A three-year schedule of investment in K-12, as proposed by SB 139, is the minimum of which we can help offset the cost of doing business. If it remains unchanged for another year, it will stretch district funding very thin and result in future education cuts. SB 139 is necessary for school boards to plan and sustain educational improvements to maintain current status and achieve greater improvement. I became involved in the Tugak School District in 1950, 1 month after I arrived in Alaska. It was very disjointed and very on a successful school district. In 1988,
Charlene, I appreciate your comments, but we have a lot of people we have to hear from today. Could you sum up your ideas?
Okay, good. So anyway, I support SB 139 and appreciate your efforts.
Thank you so much, Charlene, and thank you for your service with the Chugach District. Joey Eske is with the Aquarium Charter.
Hello.
Okay, thank you. If you identify yourself for the record, please, Joey.
Yes, for the record, my name is Joey Eske. I am the chair of Aquarium Charter School's Academic Policy Committee in Anchorage.
Yes, and
I would like to
we're discussing SB 139. Appreciate any comments you have.
Sure, that's what I'm calling in for. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today in regards to charter school funding. There has been quite a bit of discussion around charter schools since the governor's State of the State address and the introduction of Senate Bill 139. It appears the general consensus among lawmakers is that Alaska's charter schools are a proven and successful public school choice, and that lawmakers understand that charter schools throughout the state run on very tight budgets as a result of inconsistent interpretation of the law resulting in charter schools being funded differently from district to district. Alaska's charter schools started as an experimental model. In the almost 20 years the program has been available, charter schools have blossomed, opening up choice in public education to countless Alaskan children all around the state. Alaska's charter school laws were suitable when the program was small and experimental. However, it appears the success of the state's charter school program has made the existing laws somewhat antiquated. There are two primary areas where the charter school laws would benefit from being updated. One area is charter school program funding, or revenue sources. The second area is funding of charter school facilities. Presently, state charter school laws only mandate that districts pass through funding sources from within the BSA formula. While the intent of Senate Bill 139 clearly is to create equal access to funding for charter schools, Senate Bill 139 only addresses clarification of funds from within the BSA calculation, leaving the statutory language silent in regards to other funding sources. As it stands now, Senate Bill 139 will have essentially no financial impact on charter schools in Anchorage, as it remains up to the discretion of the district in which a charter school operates whether to pass through other funding sources, local, state, and federal, or any funds that lie outside of the BSA formula.
No.
In Anchorage, this means that almost 50% of state funds received by the district are not required to be passed through the charter school, as well as any additional local tax dollars over and above the required contribution and any federal monies. As you all know, over the past few years, the state has been funding charter school, or been funding schools in general outside of the BSA formula. With the charter school law silent with respect to this area, there is no mandate to districts on whether they must pass through state allocations, such as the state energy cost offsets. The result has been inconsistency in when, if, or how much the districts pass through to charter schools. In Anchorage, charter schools have received the money some years and not others. Accordingly, the first way in which the state's charter school laws and Senate Bill 139 can be strengthened is by adding statutory language that mandates funds outside of the DSA calculation, local, state, and federal, intended to benefit a student, shall also be passed to charter schools enrolling such students.
Joey, I have had to set a three-minute limit in order to get through everyone. You've got about 30 seconds left, so if you would sum
okay.
up.
Let's just get into the good part. The second area where charter school law could be improved is in respect to facilities. What we see now is that facilities is the most significant challenge hindering charter school growth and sustainability, and also the biggest challenge in charter school startup. Charter schools run off one program budget, and they must cover all of their operating expenses out of that, as well as their facilities costs. In Anchorage, charter schools use over 25% of their operating budget to cover facilities costs.
Thank you, Joey. And if you could conclude your comments, Joey, if you could conclude your comments, please, and please send us any written information you may have. We'd be pleased to receive that as well.
Yes, I've sent you plenty, but I have not gotten much response. What we're asking is that this committee consider a per-pupil facilities allowance, which is a common mechanism that's used in other states to support the charter schools. I think this would make a huge impact on the state's charter schools. I'm grateful for this opportunity. I'm available to stand in line for questions. And I will submit written testimony along with supporting documents and more detailed recommendations.
Oh, thank you so much, Joey. Sorry to have to put a time limit on this. Well, let's move on to Deborah Williams, Anchorage Youth Development Coalition. Are you with us, Deborah?
I am. Thank you so much. I am the Executive Director of the Anchorage Youth Development Coalition, and I'm pleased to read into the record today a resolution that was signed by 30 key Anchorage and statewide nonprofit organizations. And so I will read quickly, but I think the contents of this resolution are very important, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Deborah.
Whereas investing in the education of Alaska's children and youth is of utmost importance to their future and to the future of our state. Whereas we are dedicated to helping children, youth, and adults thrive, whereas public education is crucial to the success of Alaska's social, political, and economic systems, whereas we understand, often firsthand, the significant adverse costs to our community and state when youth drop out of school and fail to graduate, whereas we know both statistically and through our experiences that the number of children and youth in our schools who are economically disadvantaged has increased from 26% in 2004 to over 45% in 2012, and that it is vitally important to help these young youth succeed through additional investment in their education, whereas the primary source of funds for education in Alaska is the base student allocation, whereas the BSA has not been increased in 4 years, whereas the Anchorage School District has already made significant cuts which have eliminated or reduced important services to help youth succeed, including summer school and middle school and college counselors, whereas the Anchorage School District has prepared and is executing its Destination 2020 goals in alignment with the 90% by 2020 partnership, including increasing graduation rates, but continued progress on these goals is in jeopardy if the BSA is not inflation-proofed. Whereas Anchorage School District is projecting a deficit of over $49 million over the next 2 years and will have to make significant and damaging cuts, including eliminating teacher positions, increasing class sizes, and reducing needed services and programs, whereas these cuts will have adverse impacts on our children, youth, and our community now and into the future. Therefore, we, the undersigned nonprofits, support increased funding of the base student allocation to reflect inflation increases for the last several years. This was signed by Access Alaska, Alan Buldal with Lutheran Social Services, Alaska Institute for Justice, Alaska Literacy Program, Alaska Youth Advocates, Allison Keir with Covenant House Alaska, Amy Simpson with Programs for Infants and Children, Anchorage Youth Development Coalition, Big Brothers Big Sisters of Alaska, Bill Donovan with CPC, Boys and Girls Club Alaska, Campfire Alaska, Catholic Social Services, Dennis McCarville with Alaska Child and Family, Elaine Dahlgren with VOA, Volunteers
of Thank you.
Alaska.
Thank you, Deborah. We do have that resolution. It's posted with the bill. If you could sum up, please.
Yes. And so I was just going to continue, and that is continue to read the tremendous support reflected in this resolution for inflation-proofing the BSA, and we certainly hope that the Senate bill before you, in fact, adequately inflation-proofs the BSA. We thank you so much. This is so crucial, and as one person said, education cuts do not heal. We can't afford these cuts, and for the sake of our state, we thank you for your investment in education and having the BSA be increased to reflect inflation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Deborah. And as I say, we do have the resolution and appreciate your sending it on to us. Lisa Rieger, Cook Inlet Tribal. Lisa?
Yes, hello. Thank you. Thank you, Senator and the committee. We, on behalf of CITC, I wanted to just say we support Senate Bill 139, and we do understand, I want to speak to just one issue. We understand the fiscal concerns of school districts regarding the transportation issue, but our research has shown that transportation is a really big barrier in the implementation of charter schools and the effectiveness, especially for low-income and disadvantaged students to whom many charter schools are directed in order to close the achievement gap. So we felt compelled to go on the record and state that we support both equity in facilities as well as in transportation for the charter schools, and regret that that has been removed from the bill.
Well, thank you for your comments.
That's all.
Thanks very much. Let's come here to Juneau, and we'll begin with Marie Marks from Juneau. Marie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. As you know, my name is Marie Marks, and I'm a Juneau resident. I'm a Juneau School District graduate and parent of two children currently in the Juneau School District. I've served on school site councils for about 7 years and currently serve as the Zonta Kahini Middle School Site Council Chair. First, thank you to the legislature for the investments you have made in our schools. We know you have, and we do sincerely thank you. However, our schools need a predictable annual increase to the base student allocation to allow schools to keep up with rising costs. The current system, where districts rely on an unpredictable one-year boost in funding, undercuts the school's ability to do long-range responsible financial planning. Great things are happening in the Juneau School District. Because of these targeted investments the schools have made, such as adopting higher standards and upgrading curriculum and materials to meet these higher standards. For example, in Juneau, the graduation rate increased from 70 to 79%. The dropout rate is the lowest it's ever been. And at Zonta Kahini Middle School, objective data shows the school's test results are the highest now, and the school climate survey results are the highest now they've ever been in the history of the school. Because of the current flat funding model, we'll likely lose programs and services which has helped put schools like Zonta Kahini Middle School on the right track. We are working hard to continue this upward momentum, but we need your help. An annual predictable increase in public education funding in amounts sufficient to keep up with rising costs is crucial for long-range responsible financial planning. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. I appreciate your coming in. David Brighton from Tyonic. David? Good to see you again, David. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is David Brighton. I'm a teacher in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. I work in Tyonic, which is a small native village. There I'm the RTI coordinator, and we did not have a teaching position for the first half of the semester, or for the first semester of this current school year, which made it it made it very, very difficult for us to implement the RTI process and to work with those kids that are struggling and below the performance standards where we'd like them to be. We have received a teacher now. The RTI process is working much better. We're seeing test scores come up. My concern is that teacher does not have a contract for next year, that the funds have not been allocated. I'm asking the committee to consider inflation-proofing the BSA so that school districts can be more steady with their funding, and we don't see these cuts. They do make a big difference to small village schools especially. I thank you for the next 3 years of increases. I hope that you guys could make that a permanent thing.
Thank you very much, David. Appreciate you being with us. Todd Hindman. Todd from Nome.
My name's Todd Hindman. I'm the principal teacher at Enville City Science Academy in Nome, Alaska, a successful charter school for the past 16 years. I'm thankful and happy to see proposed legislation that provides flexibility for the implementation of new charter schools and continued operation of well-established programs. During this session, two of the more common challenges charter schools face are beginning to be addressed: facilities and financing. I will echo previous comments that more needs to be done to ensure charter school funding makes its way directly to charter school classrooms and their students. It is my hope that the governor and the legislature will continue to seek ways to strengthen our current charter school statutes that provide the accountability that charter schools should be held to by local school districts. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Hindman. Appreciate your being here and commenting. Adela Diaz. Adela? Now we have Adela, Heather, and Wes signed up. If they're here or staying here, we'd love to have you speak. If not,
Adela, yeah, I'm sorry, she's one of my students, and I think she didn't realize when she signed up.
That's okay. Heather, no. Does Heather know wish to speak?
Sorry. And I said that we were not testifying.
Perfectly okay. And Wes Andrews. Oh, there you are, Wes. Thanks. And if you'd identify yourself for the record.
I'm Wes Andrews. I'm a school counselor at Kennett Peninsula Borough School District. I concur that it would be best for our district and for the districts around the state to have more reliable increase to the BSA. School counselors are often in a position where sometimes we're more easily on the chopping block, which is kind of a shame, and because we do provide a pretty essential service. I know in Anchorage School District, for example, they had been cutting counselors last year and the year before. Our school district, Kennett School District, has been more favorable to counselors, but we are, you know, losing at least a half this year. My job's safe, but just kind of speaking on behalf of my counterparts, that more reliable funding to the BSA would help us out.
Absolutely. Thank you, Wes, and thanks for your work in the district. Appreciate that. Greg Reynolds from Sitka. Mr. Reynolds, are you with us?
I am.
Two more people.
My name is Greg Reynolds. I am the executive director of Southeast Career Consortium. And I wanted to address Section 18, the TVET portion of SB 139. We agree with the changes that you wrote into Section 18, with one exception, is that our organization is not included in this list. Our organization is the AWIB-designated Regional Training Center for Southeast Alaska. We were involved with the creation of the Regional Training Center programs. We were there when TVEP was set up. And I think the record is going to show that TVEP was set up to support regional training centers. It's a very extensive process in collaboration with the region to set up your plans and to implement those plans. And as of yet, we have not been able to participate in this program. So the last two organizations on the new TVET list are not regional training centers. I'm not sure if that was an oversight or not, but we would ask that you would include us in the organization. We're the last region of the state. So That would be my input on Section 18.
Well, thank you very much, Greg, and certainly is our intention to attempt to allow and find a way to bring organizations in that have not been a part of TVEP, so that's a work in progress, and we'll continue working on that. Thank you for your comments, Greg. Let's move on to Tammy in Fairbanks. Tammy, I'll actually ask you to pronounce your last name for me, please.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please go ahead, Tammy. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Tammy Gongoli. My address is 2530 Allendale Road, 99709 Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm in District, I believe, C with Click Bishop and House Representative Higgins, I believe. I'm here representing myself as a Fairbanks resident. I have been trying to spin myself up rapidly on the BSA and the foundation formula, and I've been doing so since early last fall. And the one thing that I know for sure is already this year with the flat funding, because of the flat funding in the past, our schools' class sizes are increasing. Some schools have, like, for first grade, for example, 31 kids already. We don't have enough desks for the students. We don't have enough supplies. And so that's why I wanted to testify in support of increasing the base student allocation. I have one question, and I apologize because I'm not that savvy yet. The 5,765 in section on page 9, line 25, is that the governor's proposed increase, or is that higher than what the governor proposed?
That is the governor's increase. Tammy, we have other bills that that we'll be considering that have a higher amount. Intention,
yes,
is to send all of those on to finance as they will be making the decision on the dollar amount.
Okay, so I'm here requesting humbly that the dollar amount for the increase to the BSA be considerably higher, because the last, I know it's probably not possible, I wish it were, but it should be more over $400 increase, and it should be sustained, as the lady said earlier, for year to year, and also for increases to expenses such as inflation, because if you don't sustain the increase, if you don't make the increase higher, our schools will not be whole. It's a step in the right direction, but we need our schools to be whole. What we're seeing now is larger class sizes, not enough supplies, not even desks to sit in. Now with the budget cuts because of this the governor's proposed increase. We're thankful that it is an increase, but it leaves an $8 million shortfall in the Fairbanks School District, which means we're going to lose over 30 teachers in the classroom. Like, we have a Citizens Budget Review Committee that meets with the board, and they could not find one more place to cut that wouldn't impact the classroom. And I've been going to the meetings and listening, and the way that you guys set up the budget and then the district sets up their budget and the board and the assembly, it's so different that there's no way for the district to plan, and they have to lay off quality people and maybe be able to reabsorb them, maybe not. It gets so complicated. We lose good people because they need to go find jobs that they can have. Our students are impacted. My particular school is a magnet school, Barnett Magnet School. We will not function the way we are supposed to function with the current proposed increase to the BSA, because we will lose two teachers, two full-time equivalents, and the second half of our day, our school kind of metamorphosizes into an exploratory environment, and we end up losing eight course offerings that are going to have to be absorbed. So our class sizes are going to be increased during the first half of the day, and then the second half of the day they're going to be increased even further. And plus we're going to be losing potential support staff are responsible for making our school perform the way it does. I want to reiterate, I'm here to request humbly that the BSA be increased further, that the number be a number that makes our schools whole, that it's sustained and predictable annually, so that our districts can plan accordingly and not have to pink flip our teachers every single year, and our teachers don't have to guess whether or not they're going to have employment until July. And it has to be enough to keep up with the costs. And the whole purpose for my supporting this is two things. One, it's in our Constitution that the state should fund public schools. And two, that a lot of you guys have been generous, and a lot of the generosity has come in dedicated funds. It hasn't come in day-to-day operations, and that's what is impacting our classroom sizes and the ability for our kids to have a quality education.
Thank you very much, Tammy, and if you would sum up, please.
I am humbly requesting that the base student allocation be increased. It needs to be more than what the governor's proposed. I'm requesting that it's increased to the amount that would make our schools whole right now, and that it would be sustained and predictable on an annual basis and keep up with inflation.
Thank you, Tammy. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to testify. I appreciate your comments. We have gone through, managed to take care of all of the folks who wanted to talk to us, testify on this issue. Remember that we are more than willing to accept any written testimony anybody wants to send. And at this point, I will close the public hearing. And if there's nothing further coming for us, we'll close this meeting. Thank you very much.